What? I can't believe I'm hearing this. Wait a minute, let me rewind.
Welcome to Wise Ones, a podcast of interviews, best practices and insights for entrepreneurship, finance, and technology, brought to you by the IBD Network, home of the Under the Radar Conferences and Dealmaker Forum. For the best of Silicon Valley, go to www.ibdnetwork.com.
Look at me. Now listen very closely.
That doesn't look like the next generation of computing to me. It's old technology.
Welcome to Wise Words, a weekly podcast of interviews on entrepreneurship, finance, and technology. I'm your host, Sean Wise.
Silence. Who chatters? But the wise man that isn't.
Welcome back to Wise Words. I'm Sean Wise, your host. You can find out more about this podcast at www.seanwise.com. This podcast, like all the Wise Words podcasts, is brought to you by the fine folks at the IBD Network for the best of Silicon Valley, www.ibdnetwork.com. We are truly blessed today to have one of Toronto's leading venture capitalists. He's an operations guy himself with 10 years experience, time in the valley under his belt, has studied business in his own way, and is currently deployed with Brightspark Ventures. I'd like to welcome Mr. Salim Teja.
Thank you, Sean, for having me.
Thank you for taking the time off from a hot, hot Toronto day.
Now,
I want to get right into it with you because you have such a good experience. I want to start with a little bit of background. Before you joined Brightspark, the website for Brightspark is brightspark.ca?
Brightspark.com.
Brightspark.com. Before you joined Brightspark, you were a founder at Mobshop. Can you tell us the story of how you went from the University of Western Ontario to being one of the founders of a Valley startup?
Sure. Well, I graduated from the Ivy School of Business at the University of Western Ontario, and found my first job at IBM. I joined the IBM PC company doing product marketing for their consumer division, and that was really my first foray into technology, and gave me a really strong sense of what it was like to work at a large technology company straddling both sort of Canada and U.S.'s product strategies, and really got a really really, really good introduction to the industry and to technology from that experience. I then left IBM to do something I thought was much more strategic, which was to join a management consulting firm based out of Seattle called MSI Consulting Group, where we really focused on building product strategies and corporate strategies for the leading technology companies. And so some of my accounts were Oracle and Apple and Microsoft, and I was very fortunate to work with a really sharp group of people who we did some very very interesting projects and focused on some very interesting technologies. We were part of the team that worked very closely with Oracle senior management as they were crafting their network computing strategy, and that was something that I was very intimately involved in, and also my firm was the initial startup team for a startup that Intel and SAP did together back in the very early mid 90s, a company called Pandesic. And so that that gave me a lot of great exposure to how companies worked in the Valley and certainly what the startup experience was like. And this was about the time when the internet was just becoming hot, and this was the sort of the 97, 98 period, and I certainly caught the bug and wanted to sort of take a shot and do something in the vein of a startup, and kept in touch with colleagues along the way, and decided that the world of e-commerce was hot, and certainly we had what we thought were pretty innovative ideas around different types of business models, and started a company called Mobshop back in 98 with two colleagues, and moved out to the Valley to really do that full time.
Now, you must have seen lots of opportunities. What drew you to decide Mobshop was where you were going to hang your hat?
Sure. Well, when I say we, it was myself and the two other founders, we spent a lot of time trying to understand sort of where the web would really create unique experiences, and this was again sort of the 98 time frame, just as the market was starting to grow and heat up, and we sort of saw really two areas that really intrigued us. The first was what was happening in e-commerce at that point in time with companies like Amazon and eBay and Priceline really creating unique experiences online and being able to get to critical mass very, very quickly, and that intrigued us. The second thing that we noticed was, you know, we felt that the web was a really good mechanism to create community, to bring together disparate people from, you know, across the country or across the planet to bring them together around common interests and common actions. And we sort of put those two concepts together, and that really formed the basis of Mobshop, which essentially was a group buying site and a group buying platform, essentially taking people who wanted to purchase similar goods and services and pooling them together in real time to allow them to conduct really high volume based transactions directly with manufacturers and distributors. And so that was the initial concept of Mobshop.
Now, back in the day, almost any good initial concept got funded, but mm-hmm. not every good concept got the funders like you had, Mayfield and one of the founders of the Net himself, Mark Anderson, and GE mm-hmm. Capital. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Sure. Well, you know, when we started Mobshop, you know, initially started in Toronto. We didn't really have access to seed stage venture capital at that point in time. There really weren't a lot of folks in Canada that did that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm not even sure there were that many seed funds.
Exactly.
The BDC wasn't doing seed work, and Ventures West was still pretty early in those days. I mean, seed capital in Canada was very thin back then.
Exactly. So we did what all aspiring entrepreneurs do at that point in time, is really go to our friends and family to raise an angel round, essentially. And we raised about $500,000 from friends and family. And that gave us a little bit of cash to put down some roots in the valley, try and get access to some bigger investors, and allow us to initially build a prototype of the technology in order to really prove out our concept and prove out user behavior. And so we really, you know, it was a gut check time for us as we sort of took that big step in terms of quitting our jobs and diving into the startup full force, but you know, we certainly did it and moved out to the valley and built an initial prototype. You know, we're able to attract a few employees who really believed in our vision and the opportunity. And you know, one of the first things we did as we were going out and really educating people about what we were up to is we ended up talking to a bunch of different analysts and a bunch of different reporters. And you know, very quickly, I think our concept caught on, and we were actually invited to present at one of Forrester Research's consumer forums that they were doing in New York. And that was really our big unveiling as a company. We were selected as one of the startups to watch through that conference, and that really just started a snowball effect for us. It drew the attention of a lot of VCs. It drew the attention of a lot of smart people in the industry and gave us the opportunity to build a very strong board of advisors. And one of the fellows that we initially had on as our board of advisors was a fellow by the name of Rich Colgard, who was the publisher of Forbes magazine. And he was the one who really gave us an introduction into the Valley VCs and gave us a chance to really pitch our vision and our team to investors like Mayfield. Mark Andreessen got involved because he actually said to us that he had actually thought of something like this while he was at Netscape and thought that the web was really a great platform to be able to do this sort of community-based commerce. So he actually sought us out and gave us a call and told us that he had wanted to invest and join our board. And that was
it's always nice when they come to you with the
checks. Absolutely. It was a great endorsement for the concept and certainly, you know, allowed us to continue to surround ourselves with really, really smart people.
So take us forward a little bit in the life of Mobshop, and how did it turn out? What were the highlights? What were the lowlights? Where did it wrap up?
Sure. Well, you know, 98 was really the initial start of the ramp of the heated activity in the internet space, really the start of the bubble, as some call it. And we certainly got caught up in that growth cycle. We ended up growing the company to about 100, 150 people with properties, commerce properties, not only in North America but all across Europe as well. We raised about $50 million in venture capital, with the main strategy being to gain critical mass and scale the business as quick as possible, because that's what had worked for eBay, that's what had worked for
Now, did
Priceline.
You say 50 or 1-5?
50.
So $50 million. I almost feel like this is a Dr. Evil statement. So you raise $50 million, it's the heat of the bubble, where does it go from there?
And a lot of it was spent on sales and marketing, and then really trying to get the critical mass for that our model really needed in order for it to work. And I think we certainly rode the wave of activity as the market got hot, and unfortunately got caught as the cycle turned and everything cooled down in the commerce space, specifically in the consumer space. And we really needed to scale back the business and needed to really zig and zag the strategy in order to see if there was an opportunity to really continue the momentum of the company. We launched an enterprise version of the company. We started getting approached by large B2B exchanges and corporations who are interested in internally pooling their purchase power to renegotiate volume-based contracts with their vendors. And so we found a really intriguing opportunity to license the technology to some very large companies in order to pursue that. And we started to get some traction in that space, and then all of a sudden the B2B market collapsed from under us, and unfortunately we ran out of places to zig and zag and had to at that point in time decide to do what was best for the investors and best for the company, which was to slowly wind down the operations. We actually took our Canadian team and they all went to BCE Emerges here in Toronto, became part of their commerce team there, and that's sort of how the entire venture ended, really getting caught in the market dynamics that existed at that point in time.
Now, Salim, you often hear from boxers and from Ultimate Fighters that they learn more from their losses than they learn from their wins. What do you think you learned in a nutshell from the experience that you had?
Well, I think a couple things. I think the first was that, if you truly believe in your idea and you truly believe that, you can turn it into a business, that, the big first step is to take that risk, take that plunge and jump right into it. And good things start to happen once you fully commit yourself to an opportunity. And I think that certainly what we found ourselves going through was certainly through doing a lot of hard work, but at the same time getting lucky through the process. And I think that, it was really important for us to first take that plunge, secondly, surround ourselves with smart people to sort of figure stuff out as we were really growing the company and going through the experience. Because at the end of the day, there aren't often very right or wrong answers, but just really need to have an answer as you're facing some of these challenges and opportunities. And so, certainly surrounding yourself with the right people and will be willing to take that risk.
Absolutely. Now, the next risk you took, you sort of put one foot into the dark side and you became an entrepreneur in residence for Mosaic Venture Partners. Can you tell me how that came about?
Sure. Well, certainly after we had gone through the Mob Shop experience, I needed a bit of time to sort of catch my breath and sort of see what was happening in other areas of the market. I ended up coming back to Canada and really found a lot of the technology activity happening in Toronto. And ended up meeting with a bunch of venture capital firms who were really interested in sort of bringing more Valley experience in-house and also bringing in a lot of operational experience in-house. And so I ended up doing an entrepreneur-in-residence type of opportunity, with the goal being to really identify some, very, very early stage opportunities and apply some of my operational experience and potentially some VC money to really take these companies to the next level. So it was an interesting experience for me to be now sitting on the other side of the equation, going out and seeking entrepreneurs and really trying to place the bets from an investor standpoint.
Let's talk about that for just a moment. When you were in the dark side, or you were inside the people who are making the investments, you must have opened your eyes a little bit. What was the most surprising thing that you learned?
Well, I think certainly when you're on the investor side, I think that you have to keep in mind that venture capital investing is a business on its own. There are certain goals and financial models that an investment needs to follow in order for it to generate the types of returns that that the investor needs to give back to their limited partners. And so, you know, part of the equation around why deals are structured the way they are, it is just to make the business model work for the investment community. And so, you know, very often when you're negotiating with an entrepreneur or being on the other side of the table trying to understand why a deal is structured the way it is, it really is because of the model of a VC who really needs to go after high growth opportunities within a certain time frame to generate an enough of a return to meet their requirements back to their LPs. And so that's really why deals are structured the way they are. And I think learning the mechanics of that was certainly eye-opening for me from an investor standpoint.
Now, it obviously wasn't enough because you put the other foot on the dark side. You sort of did an Anakin Skywalker. You went halfway and then you went all the way over and you decided to join up with one of Canada's leading seed funds, the archangels of investment capital. You joined BrightSpark. Now, I got to ask, you were already an EIR at one fund. How did you end up at another fund?
Well, you know, I think what I was, you know, on the investor side, I certainly liked meeting the experience of meeting with different types of entrepreneurs and really evaluating opportunities. And if I thought it was something I was good at, and I certainly thought that it would be an interesting career move for me. But more so than that, I think what I found was that, you know, as you look at the amount of investors out there, you know, in Canada and also in the U.S., I think they really fall into two camps. There are folks who approach the process very academically, and yet that there are others who've actually gone through the company building process and can really relate to the entrepreneur and I think take a very different perspective to how venture capital works. And I thought that there was a real opportunity to join a firm that had much more of an operational approach to working with startups, very, very early stage startups, as opposed to doing things much more academically. And I found BrightSpark. They're, you know, certainly started by Mark Skipinker and Tony Davis, who founded a company called Delrina back in the day in the 80s. And since then, you know, both them together and separately have started a bunch of other technology companies. And what I found as I built my relationship with them was really, you know, they had a very different approach to investing in companies and working with founders. I think it was an approach that was very consistent with the way I thought venture capital should work, and also, you know, certainly fit well with my prior experience having been on the other side of the table, just as Mark and Tony have been, you know, really taking, you know, venture capital for their own companies that they've started. And so I found it to be a really good fit for a model targeted to very, very early stage and seed investing.
Let's talk a little bit about the model. What's BrightSpark's sweet spot, and how does it sort of differ from other more traditional Canadian funds or even traditional funds around the world?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, a lot of investors, a lot of VCs say that they do early stage, but their definition of early stage is really quite different than our definition. Very often investors who say they're looking at early stage still want to see, you know, some technology there, some early reference customers, some path to revenue, path to profitability, a business model in place. And for us, that's quite late in the process. At BrightSpark, we really focus on truly very, very early stage seed opportunities. You know, that could be two guys in an idea, two guys in a PowerPoint, to a space that we like, that we go out and assemble a team to really go after a market opportunity, to, in some instances, you know, folks who have come to us with an early product prototype and want to discuss the potential of their technology. So we really are getting involved at the very, very early idea or conception stage, and we're very comfortable in that space, and that's really where we tend to focus.
So just to paraphrase, where most people want that sort of talent triangle, that business experience, that domain knowledge, that technology, you're happy to have one or two of those elements. Which are the elements most important to you when you look at an investment?
Well, I think we really look for three things. The first is, you know, our fundamental belief is that when you're in this business, it's all about the people. It's about investing in people. And so the first thing that we look for is we really want to find world-class experts in the field that we're looking at. So domain expertise to us is critical. And again, this whole concept of, you know, finding really smart people to go after markets, I think will come up time and time again as something that we believe is really key to taking advantage of some of these opportunities. So the first is domain expertise. The second is, you know, we want to go after opportunities that are addressing really, really large market opportunities. You know, people have to remember that venture capital is all about building high growth companies. And, you know, when we have a certain investment horizon, we need to make sure that a company can build some significant technology and attract some significant revenue within a short period of time. And that's really what makes our model work. And so, you know, we need to see significant market opportunities existing in these spaces. And then thirdly, we tend to focus exclusively on the software market, whether that's enterprise software or software as a service or embedded software. But really what we're looking for is some type of intellectual property being created or some approach to building barriers or to entry that can help the company protect its head start in a given market. And so those are sort of the three areas that we tend to look very carefully at.
And one of the things that we have to look carefully at is the time and make sure that we get our sponsors in. We'll be right back with Salim Teja, Vice President, BrightSpark.
Take a trek home to the Rocky Mountains and discover what many in North America consider one of the most exciting forums of its kind. Come and meet the brightest minds and the best prospects for investment in the business of information and communications technology at the BAM Venture Forum 2006, September 21st and 22nd, 2006, at the Rimrock Resort Hotel in beautiful Banff, Alberta, Canada. For more information, visit BAMVentureForum.org.
And we're back. You're listening to Wise Words, Lessons in Entrepreneurship and Venture Capital, brought to you by the IBD Network. For the best of Silicon Valley, www.ibdnetwork.com. Check out the latest conferences, Under the Radar Mobile and Momentum, coming in the fall. We are talking today with someone with 10 years of operational and venture capital experience in the technology industry, someone who I consider to be a good friend, someone who really knows a thing or two about starting companies. He's the Vice President of BrightSpark Ventures, which can be found at www.brightspark.com. He is Salim Teja. Thanks for staying with us.
Thanks, Sean.
I want to move a little bit into some best practices. Now, I got to ask you, how many pitches do you think you and Steve and Mark and Tony see a year?
Well, we probably see on a weekly basis, we probably see, you know, 15 to 20 different plans cross our desk. So it certainly is a lot of volume that we need to go through.
And if you had to sort of point out two or three common correctable errors that you see in these 10 to 15, what would you kind of focus on?
Well, you'd be surprised to sort of hear that, you know, sometimes or very often, actually, people have a very difficult time really articulating their business or their focus area. And
maybe they need to read the column a little more.
I think, you know, I know you've talked about the concept of an elevator pitch and being able to succinctly really talk a little bit about the value proposition, the technology, the team, and the opportunity. And I think that, you know, a lot of times people forget about the importance of that and being able to appropriately communicate what they're doing. And I think
what kills me is that if you can't convey your message in a short period, it makes you wonder if you're truly focused. If you can't convey it, the pain point, how are you going to convey it to future clients? I mean, it's great to come into a VC and kind of give an overview, but if you want to, you know, get down to brass tacks and really talk about scalability and traction and where we can go with it, you have to get past the "so what is it that you do?" question.
Absolutely, and I think that you know, very very often, you know, that ability to convey that really crisp and clear message, I think, distills a lot of confidence in the team. And if you can't extract that sort of clear message from the team, I think it starts to hurt the confidence that we have for that particular venture. And so that's why I think it becomes of paramount importance.
So being able to give a succinct elevator pitch with confidence is definitely a mistake that some people make. What are other common things that are correctable that people do?
Well, I also think that it's important for people to really do a little bit of research around the types of investors that they're approaching as they're going out there. Certainly, if you are a semiconductor venture, you shouldn't be going after a VC who only focuses on software, for example. And so really trying to understand more about the audience that you're targeting and making sure that what you're saying and what you're proposing is relevant to them, I think is really, really important, because very often entrepreneurs just sort of take a shotgun approach and send their plans just everywhere. And that really does a lot of disservice to them, and I think, certainly draws out the process in terms of trying to find the right types of investors for their ventures. So,
but again, it amazes me because, Celine, I mean, you wouldn't go try to sell every type of customer. You would want to focus on those people that match up. You need to use this sort of rifle, not a shotgun approach. I'm always amazed in our boot camp we tell the story of the life science company that tried to get money from TELUS Ventures.
Right.
And I mean, unless you're going to put a phone inside someone's head, it's not likely TELUS Ventures is going to be fundable.
Absolutely.
I think you guys are wonderful, but I wouldn't take a molecular chemical product to you because it's not the space you're in.
Yeah, and I think, all that information is readily available on the web in terms of the profile of the investors, and I think it just, it's just part of the process that an entrepreneur should go through. And then finally, I think repeatedly, time and time again, I think, entrepreneurs, come with very different expectations around what a venture capitalist is and how the venture capital model works. And I think that, I think it would be helpful for people to really take the time and effort to understand how our business model works, what we bring to the table as part of the opportunity. And I think, entrepreneurs really need to understand whether they're prepared for that type of partnership, because, it's not like going to the bank and getting a loan for a business. This is really a really deep business partnership that you're getting into with a venture firm, and I think the entrepreneur and their team needs to be prepared for that type of experience.
Well, let's use this platform and this opportunity to dispel some myths. Let's do a little bullet time. How about a couple of things that you're amazed to hear that people have expectations around? So I'll go first. I'll give you one.
Sure.
The fact that you can actually get away with saying, our estimates are conservative.
Right.
What about one from you?
Yeah, I think also people very often underestimate the certainly the amount of time and due diligence that's required to really get a deal done. I mean, it's not about giving one pitch, filling out a bank form, and hopefully getting the check in the mail. VCs go through a lot of time and effort to really get to know the team, to get to know the technology strategy in the market. And so I think entrepreneurs really need to be cognizant of just how long the process can take and be prepared for that type of process.
I was in a pitch once with another fund that I won't name, and they asked the entrepreneur, so when do you sort of run out of cash? What's your runway like? What sort of, the timelines do you have in mind? When do you need the money? And the answer was Thursday. And I sat there going, like, are you serious? Like, you think that someone can... They don't realize that you have your own internal processes and that they have to be aware of them. Another thing that I like to try to shatter in expectations is that you can't do top-down market assessment. You can't say that, there's 5 billion people in the world and they all have feet, so we're going to sell shoes to all of them. Mm-hmm. That's very pre-bubble sort of thing. What about another myth that you're amazed to hear?
Well, I also... I think very often, if you've done the right job at targeting your VC, they're probably going to have a lot of different perspectives on the opportunity and be probably very well educated on the space that you're targeting than probably the entrepreneur would ever imagine. And so, I think very often, entrepreneurs come in and think that they're really pitching to dumb money, when in fact, we spend so much time dealing with very different types of companies in all different types of spaces, that I think, we can certainly get up to speed fairly quickly and really distill the issues and opportunities down to some really key points. And so hopefully if the an entrepreneur is doing their research, they'll be able to have intelligent conversations with the investors that they're going after.
So
that it's not dumb money, essentially.
So let's fast forward. Let's say you found the smart money. You've convinced them that you have a competitive advantage, and you're the ones to bet on in a space that they're comfortable with. And you get to the a key milestone in the investment process, which is the term sheet, mm-hmm. which always amazes me, again, around expectations and people's predispositions to thinking that they understand it. What sort of things do you find that most entrepreneurs focus on the term sheet, and where do you think they really should be focused on?
Well, I think the first area that everyone tends to focus on is valuation. And, of course, as an entrepreneur, you want to get the highest possible valuation that you can possibly get. And as an investor, I think you're trying to get a valuation that you believe to be fair relative to other investments that you've made or seen or are currently doing in order to keep the metrics in line in terms of our own business model. And
so that's a key thing that people don't realize. I want to highlight it just for a second. A lot of people feel that valuation is determined solely by intrinsic factors, where you are, how many MBAs you have, how many engineers you have, how much technology. They don't realize that there's extrinsic factors around supply and demand of capital, other deals you're looking at internally.
Absolutely. So I think every deal that we look at is always placed relative to other deals that we're looking at or we've recently done. And again, at the end of the day, what we're trying to evaluate is, which of those opportunities is going to create the greatest amount of value for us within the shortest period of time. And then that's really where we tend to focus our efforts in trying to differentiate things. So, you can go through, certainly as an entrepreneur, I think you need to realize whether you want to, certainly you want the number to be really, really high and potentially be unrealistic from an investor standpoint, or whether you want to, find a happy medium with the investor and quickly get on to company building. And that's always a delicate dance that the investor and entrepreneur go through. But, at the same time, the longer that process takes, the greater the likelihood that, either the investor will move on to something new, or the market opportunity will pass, or other issues may pop up through that process. So I think it's important to sort of manage the expectations around that very carefully.
So let's put valuation aside for a minute. Where else do you find that entrepreneurs get stuck, and where do you think they really should be more focused on?
Well, I think, certainly for us, when we structure an investment, we tend to really focus around identifying specific business milestones that the company is going to be driven towards. I think very often entrepreneurs, once they get through the valuation thing, get stuck up on shareholder rights and board rights and really the mechanics of the term sheet, which quite often are very standard and I think give, I believe, the entrepreneur and the investor on both sides adequate amount of protection. But, what the entrepreneur should really be focusing on is, once I get this money, what am I going to be doing with it? Does it give me enough runway? And can we all agree on the milestones that the company is going to reach in order to give the investor confidence that it was a worthwhile investment? And I think that very often, entrepreneurs forget about going through the operational budget process and the milestone process. Because actually the reality is once you get the check, that's when the hard work really, really begins. And you've got to be prepared to know what you want to do with it and how long it's going to last you and instill confidence in the investor that you're moving the company forward.
Couldn't agree with you more. So let's talk about that. Once you get the check, what are sort of the most important tasks that you, as either a board member or an investment manager for a fund, are sort of looking forward to in the first 90 or 120 days? What are the first things the entrepreneurs need to, sort of deploy on?
Well, I think the first thing is making sure that that they have the appropriate team in place to really deliver on the initial milestones, which very often for us tend to be technology milestones. When we're talking about a seed or concept stage company, very often they've got the initial elements of an idea or perhaps initial thoughts on a technology, but really the first 90 days needs to be focused on making sure that the appropriate tech team is in place to deliver on appropriate prototype or version one of the product. That the company starts, acting like a startup itself, making sure they have the right operational processes in place, that they get office space, that they start to look and feel like a business. but at the same time have the discipline of frugality, which I think all startups need to pursue in order to, you know, really, you know, keep that discipline in place. And so for us, it's, you know, the first 90 days generally tend to be about hitting some technology milestones and really beefing up the team to the appropriate level to allow them to sort of push things forward.
Now, you've had an opportunity to work with some great portfolio companies. I know Now Public just closed around, and Tierra Wireless is one of yours, and the VoIP Shield play was a good one, and Border Free and Think Dynamics. So looking back on those plays and your own experience and the experience of your partners, what do you think the hardest thing in the first year of operations for most startups are?
Well, I think that, you know, inevitably every startup that we've worked with has gone through a process where they continuously need to critique and question the strategy and the markets that they're going after. And I think, you know, one of the challenges is that if you tend to close your eyes and just run in one direction without paying attention to what's going on around you, you can fairly quickly find yourself lost out in the middle of nowhere with very little help. And I think, you know, very often the companies that we invest in and work with need to go through what we call a zig and zag process. As they're sort of out there building their technology, learning from customers, learning from partners, really what, you know, a lot of these companies tend to do is move towards opportunities as they get more information about the markets that they're in. And I think, you know, as a young company, that is certainly an asset. You know, I mean, you don't see companies like IBM and Microsoft being able to change strategies and move directions as quickly as a young startup can. And so that characteristic should really be used as an asset. And I think, you know, as a startup team, you need to continuously be evaluating the markets, the products, the technologies that you're going after to incorporate as much of the feedback as you can into the business plan.
Well, I think that that's very important to focus on, and I hope all of our listeners are paying attention, and I hope they pay attention to this commercial message from our sponsors.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. Talking to you. Look at me. Canadian Tech Mob. That's what it's all about. You need to join. Hit the website. www.CanadianTechMob.com. Show your support. Join the mob.
And we're back. As always, we wrap up the Wise Words podcast by asking the three magical questions. We are talking today with Salim Teja, Vice President of Brightspark, one of Canada's leading seed funds that focuses on software. Thanks very much for staying with us.
Thanks, Sean.
Let's start with question number one on our magic question list. Salim, what is the best advice you have ever received?
Well, I think it's, you know, as you're endeavoring to do new and interesting things, always surround yourself with smart people and people that you respect and trust. I think time and time again, as we see, you know, entrepreneurs and teams going out, taking the risk to build a business, it's all about the people and the relationships with the people that you have on your team. And I think you can't succeed unless you have you know, really sharp people working with you, working for you, and being able to respect and trust everyone's opinions and their thinking as part of the process. And so that's something that I've personally done throughout my career, and hope, you know, certainly look for as we make our investments in very young companies.
Definitely some wise words. Let's move on to our second question. I know it's hard to believe, but I'm sure you've made a mistake or two in your professional career. So if we look back on one of these big mistakes, what was it, and what can we learn from it?
Well, I think, you know, certainly being either way, you know, whether you're an entrepreneur or you're an investor, I think you have to be comfortable in taking risks and being prepared for the process of taking risks. And certainly I wish I had, you know, gotten comfortable with that whole experience, you know, certainly as earlier as I could because I think it just, if you're not comfortable with that process of taking a risk, it just delays your ability to be successful either as an entrepreneur or as an investor. And so I think, you know, if you choose to pursue either of these career paths, you know, being able to take risks and being comfortable with that type of decision making is really important to success. And the earlier you can get comfortable with that, I think the more time you'll have to learn and to sort of pursue some of these opportunities. I certainly wish I had gotten comfortable with it and learned it earlier, so I could have jumped into the startup space much earlier than I did. But I think it's always a learning process.
Absolutely. So far we have surround yourself with smart people that you can trust and then trust them. Don't be afraid of risk and getting comfortable with it at an early stage. Our final question for you today, and then we'll let you get back to the good job that you're doing at BrightSpark, is if you could give our listeners one piece of advice, either before meeting you or one piece of advice as they go and start their great adventure that is being a startup founder, what is that advice that you'd share?
Well, I think, you know, certainly have confidence in yourself and confidence in the opportunity. And I think that, as I said, we look for you know, when we're investing, we look to invest in bright people who have confidence in what they're talking about and what they envision. And I think that confidence is really key. It enables you to take the first step into the world of entrepreneurship, and it allows you to have some meaningful conversations with investors as you go through that process. So confidence is really the key, and everyone needs to be sort of prepared for that type of experience.
Well, I'd like to thank you for making this conversation meaningful. I'd like to express my appreciation for it and suggest that everyone should give a read of your blog, which they'll find at www.brightspark.com. We have been talking to Salim Teja, Vice President of BrightSpark. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
This has been the Wise Words podcast, brought to you by the fine folks at the IBD Network. For the best of Silicon Valley, including the under-the-radar conferences, www.ibdnetwork. We'll be right back.
IBD Network, the producers of the acclaimed Under the Radar Conference, are hosting the Momentum Growth Conference September 27th through 28th, 2006, at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. Join tech heavyweights including Yahoo, Google, AOL, MSN, News Corp, Viacom, and many more. This year's conference will focus on the exploding digital convergence ecosystem, from content creation to distribution and everything in between. For more information, visit MomentumConf.com.
And that wraps up another interview and another podcast. You've been listening to the Wise Words podcast, brought to you by the fine folks at IBD Network. For the best of Silicon Valley, go to www.ibdnetwork.com. Tune in next week for more best practices, insights, and interviews on entrepreneurship, finance, and technology. Till then, I'm your host, Sean Wise. You can reach me at www.seanwise.com. Thank you, and good venture.